Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. The program is a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. I couldn't be more pleased to have with us one of the most influential and I think respected and impactful members of the United States House of Representatives. His name is Congressman Chris Stort of Utah. He has been a successful businessman, before that a highly decorated pilot in the Air Force. He has the world's record for around-the-world high-speed transit in a B-1 bomber. He has written prolifically, including New York Times bestsellers. And he's a member these days, not only the House Appropriations Committee, but also the House Intelligence Committee. He's a good friend. We're delighted to have a chance to visit with him about some topics that I know are top of mind for him, and that should be for all of us. Congressman, it's great to have you back. Welcome, sir.
It's always good to be with you, Frank. You're so gracious in your introductions. You always make my day. So I come on your show for no other reason, so thank you.
It's just reading your resume, sir, in very brief form. So I want to talk to you about a matter that is, I think, top of mind for those of us in the national security community. And that is, we're hearing now daily more and more and more evidence about the extent to which the Biden family, not just Hunter, not just the president's brother, not the other member, the president of the United States himself, have been deeply compromised by, among others, the Chinese Communist Party. I'm on a mission here to try to make sure that the public has some understanding of what the national security implications are of that. Set aside, you know, the corruption and the fact that it causes us real concern, I think, what has to, about the character of the individuals involved. But you've been in the national security, well, business for a very long time, sir. Now you're overseeing the intelligence community. What does it mean that the Chinese communists have the president of the United States, well, in their pocket?
Well, I think, Frank, I'd say a couple things, and then I want to directly answer your question. But before I do, a couple observations, like I said. Number one is, this information that's available today, that's available last week, that we're suddenly talking about, isn't new information. It's been available for 18 months. But for some reason, our society and the media and others are set up, well, it's not true until the New York Times says it's true, or until the Washington Post says it's true, and then suddenly it's true. So many of us have been frustrated because we've known all of this information now since the laptop was first discovered and first discussed, which was, as you know, several weeks before the election. The second thing is, there's no question there are entanglements between not just Hunter Biden, but between other members of the Biden family, including brothers and including the president himself. Otherwise, who else is the big guy? Someone tell us who that is, if it's not the president, because others have come forward, partners and others, who have firsthand knowledge of this. And once again, Frank, to repeat myself, who've said 18 months ago, this isn't new, that the big guy is indeed the president. And last thing, observation is, we're seeing this projection. I mean, for 5 years, we were told President Trump is a puppet of Russian government. President Trump is a puppet of Vladimir Putin. And of course, none of that was true. And while that's being said, we know as well that this president, while he was in office as vice president and then as a private citizen, was facilitating all sorts of business dealings. And these weren't just, you know, a couple hundred dollars here and there. They're millions, potentially tens of millions of dollars. And how can we ever tell the American people that they can have confidence in this president if we can't answer that question that you put forward, and that is, how influenced is he by foreign entanglements as they have described it, and to really understand how deep those go?
Yeah. But as you know, sir, nobody in the food chain, if you would wish, south of the president of the United States, would be allowed to serve for a moment in a sensitive position, certainly not in the Defense Department, certainly most especially not in the military services, if they had a fraction of the degree to which this gentleman has been compromised. As a national security matter, how serious a problem is it that we have foreign powers, and it isn't just the Chinese, unfortunately. The mayor of Moscow's wife gave them money, and Burisma and so on compromised them for Ukraine. Who knows who all else? You said, sir, and if I may, just a small correction, I think that what is causing the current attention to the laptop is some of this information is, well, not new in the sense that it was in the laptop, but has only just come to light, including the fact that there are encryption keys from the Defense Department that have an unexplained role in all of this. But just at the, you know, Defense 101 level, if you would, talk about what it means if our president has been batting for the other team.
Well, and so again, Frank, thanks for pointing out, you know, I said something that wasn't, I guess, in a technical sense true, because some of this is just coming to light. For example, the encryption keys. We didn't know that 18 months ago. I think by and large, the overall umbrella of this story, we knew, as I said, but we are learning more and more details. There's no question that that's true. And none of those details are good news. None of those details of that new information exonerates the president or his family. And in fact, quite the opposite. And to your first point as well, if I were a civilian contractor, if I were an employee of the NSA, whether as a contractor or as a government official, there's no way in the world I would maintain my clearance or be given a clearance, even a top secret clearance, which is the lowest one, let alone the highly compartmented clearances above that. There's no way in the world someone would be given access to that information.
Yeah, I think confidential clearance, for that matter, not alone top secret. But and to the point, if you were a military officer or an enlisted man, you'd be in the brig by about now, don't you think? I mean, this is one of those cases where you would be, unceremoniously marched out of wherever you were employed or serving. And incarcerated, I would guess. So again, to the extent that all of that is true, and we're learning more by the day, and I do want to salute Jack Maxey, who has, I think, been responsible for a lot of the forensic work that has brought this to light. Elite capture is something that is going on. It is unfortunately not confined to the president. You and Senator Marco Rubio have been warning about it. Just very quickly, we have to take a break in about a minute. Is this a problem far broader than the Biden, bad as the Biden family is?
Well, I guess the answer to that is we need to find out. And as I've expressed to you on other occasions, one of the real frustrations we have in being the minority right now is Adam Schiff has no interest at all in pursuing this. Nancy Pelosi has no interest at all in getting the answers to these questions, nor Chuck Schumer. And unfortunately, they control the levers of power in Congress right now, which is why we are counting the days until the 2022 election when we, you know, and pray it happens. It's a catastrophe for our country if it doesn't. But we will recapture the House. I think it's likely we retake the Senate. And then we pursue this and we tell the American people. That's the fair thing to do. Tell and inform the American people. And that just simply hasn't occurred to this point.
Yeah, it hasn't occurred, and it must. You're absolutely right about that. Congressman Chris Stewart is our guest. We're going to take just a very short break. And on the other side, we're going to talk a little bit about what are the political implications of Joe Biden being forced, I believe, to resign from the presidency. Something that our friend Tucker Carlson has pointed out is now apparently on the minds of a lot of his Democratic partisans as well. We'll get the take of a very accomplished political figure on the Republican side of the aisle on that and more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last night, Tucker Carlson announced a death watch for the Biden presidency. In one of the most insightful and pathetic video clips in American political history, he showed the President of the United States being shunned by former President Barack Obama and, God help us, future President Kamala Harris and everybody else at a recent White House event. Think of it as dead man shuffling. Tucker not only confirmed what I said here 10 days ago, quote, Joe must go, unquote. He powerfully showed that to now be the consensus in partisan Democratic circles. The chilling prospect of Kamala ascending and or the curtain being pulled back on what is, effectively, Obama's third term demands an urgent effort to identify and recruit a nonpartisan vice president. Someone of real accomplishment, with a robust national security background, and who will promise not to run in 2024. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with Congressman Chris Stort of Utah. He is, among other things, a distinguished veteran of the United States Air Force and also a very impressive member of the House Intelligence Committee, where he has taken a particular interest in some of the most important challenges we're facing, including from communist China. And I want to come back to that in a moment, sir. But just to talk one more moment about the Biden affair, the extent to which even Democrats now, it seems, have come to the conclusion he has got to go. What are the implications of that? Nobody, I think, on either side of the aisle has much of an appetite for Vice President Kamala Harris fleeting up to become the president. But what it will do is create an opening for another official, the new vice president. She will make the pick and the appointment will go to the Congress for approval. But can you talk a little bit about why it matters so much that we actually have somebody of, well, I'd say a caliber that has a real record in national security in the kind of dangerous world we find ourselves in and a robust position at that?
Well, and we would hope that would, you know, that individual, if we get come to that point, would have that kind of background or that interest, because it's very clear that our vice president doesn't. And she makes that more and more clear every foreign visit that she has. And, you know, Frank, I'm actually really torn on this, as I think most Americans are. What's worse for our country? To have an inept president who has, as we've said, entanglements overseas that we clearly have to understand and that perhaps have put him in a position where he's not doing what is in the best interest of his own country, and you know, the southern border and inflation and Afghanistan and the list goes on and on. Is that worse, or is it worse to go through the national strain of having him not in office, and then the uncertainty that follows after that? And both of them are dismal catastrophes for our nation, and it's not something that anyone savors, I don't think, especially after we saw these, you know, these just ridiculous impeachment proceedings against the former president. And one of my great concerns at that time was we lower the threshold for impeachment. We lower it to such a point that any president who has an opposition party in control of the House is likely to impeach for one thing or another. I don't think that's a good idea. We shouldn't have done that. But we are faced now with a situation that is very different and much more serious. And as you said, even some of our Democratic colleagues are looking at the future and they're trying to wonder, or they're wondering, how in the world do we navigate through this with some of the new information we have regarding the president? None of us savor the future, but it is what it is. And I hope that if there is a new vice president, that there is someone that we can trust, someone who actually understands the threats, someone who understands the military and intelligence and putting America first, because this administration simply hasn't done that and doesn't seem to be capable of doing that.
Yeah, it's so true. Nobody, as I say, relishes this Hobson's choice. And unfortunately, it's one of the legacies of the Joe Biden candidacy, is that he picked somebody who was manifestly inadequate to the task of actually serving as the president. I do worry, and you know, I mentioned Tucker Carlson having this very powerful program last night in which he talked about the Democrats bailing out. One of the things that he also showed, which is among the most gripping piece of footage I've ever seen, certainly in a political sense, and that was Joe Biden not simply being ignored by Barack Obama and Vice President Harris in a scrum gathering, an event at the White House yesterday, but actually being shunned. And the image that came across to me, honestly, was an answer to the question that I think has had a lot of us wondering about who's actually running the country. And it may well be that it's Barack Obama. And that makes me think it's important that this change take place and we see some new entrant who is a counterweight to the kinds of predilections of these very, very radical leftists like Obama and Harris, for that matter. Let me turn to another issue, if I can, with you. You have legislation, speaking of Tucker Carlson, you had a feature with him the other day about it, that is going after something of huge moment, Congressman Chris Stewart, and that is the weaponization of our national security agencies against the American people. Talk about the problem, if you would, and the solution you're proposing.
Yeah, again, thanks, Frank, for giving us a chance to talk about this. It's very, very important the American people know what's happening. And if they know, they should be, and I think they will be, just enraged by it. We have agencies that have been given enormous power. And I mean power in the sense of legislatively and what they have the ability to do, and also power in the sense of technologically, their ability to capture through technology very secure private communications, whether it's text, emails, or voice communications, and the list is long of what they're able to do. They've been given this enormous power because we needed to use that against our adversaries, against foreign terrorists, for example, against ISIS, against terrorist organizations in Iraq and Afghanistan, against nation states, Russia, China, the mullahs in Iran, North Korea, etc. They were never intended to be used against the American people until this administration comes along. And they said something that's just frankly ridiculous. And that is, in their appraisal, one of the greatest threats facing our country is not, again, Russia or China or terrorism. One of the greatest threats facing our country, in their minds, is white supremacy. It's what they call DVEs, domestic violent extremism. Well, again, I reject that notion. I think that is a problem, but to say it's to the scope that they've said, I think is nonsense. But then they use that as a justification for saying, well, the threat of American terrorism, domestic terrorism, is so great that we now have to use the CIA or the NSA or the DIA or others against U.S. persons to counter this threat. We should never, ever allow that. And this legislation is designed to redefine some of the executive orders that they have, frankly, twisted to their benefit to bring back that clarity saying, you will not use the intelligence community to look at U.S. persons. That's the job of law enforcement. And for them to do that, they should get a court order. And if the court allows them to, that's okay. If the FBI or local law enforcement, you will not use the intelligence community to do that. And again, I think it's just critical. I use this phrase, but I don't think it's an exaggeration. We do not want to create an American KGB. And we've already walked down that road way too far. And it's time to pull back. It's time to try to restore trust so the American people aren't suspicious of their own agencies. And you use that, you break that faith between the American people and, once again, law enforcement, Department of Justice, or now the CIA or NSA, it's just extraordinarily destructive to a republic when you've broken that faith.
It certainly is. And I think you're right. We've seen that faith broken. I've just heard a chilling report on what's been done to individuals accused of, trespassing, basically, in connection with the January 6th events. And it sounds an awful lot like the KGB is running the place if you really drill down on, punishment without trial, the extent to which people are being held in solitary confinement and deprived of, medicine that they need and on and on. It's torture in a way, and it's also a real threat to our country. So I salute you for your leadership on this point. And again, it underscores what you said earlier, Congressman Chris Stewart, and that is, what's at stake in this election coming up this fall? If there is not a turnabout, if there is not a course correction, our country is truly imperiled, because these kinds of institutional changes, what again Barack Obama has called the fundamental transformation of our country, are very, very far advanced and are very hard to turn around. And in the minority, you have a very limited ability to make a change, particularly in such an important
exactly
course
right.
correction.
And look, my view is that Republicans are the ones who are the only ones who are going to turn this around. My Democratic colleagues have no interest. In fact, they want to perpetuate it.
Indeed, they do. Congressman, I'm sorry, we are out of time, and I want to talk to you for another hour, but we're going to have to postpone that to another day soon, I hope. Thank you, Congressman Chris Stewart, for your great work in the United States Congress and all your service to our country. Come back to us with a lot more on all of this in the near future, if you would. Next up, we're going to be speaking with a man who's of the left, now seen the light.
Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. Straight ahead.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and it's a delight always to be able to say welcome to our next guest. His name is Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. He was once upon a time a Marxist professor at New York University. He was mugged by reality, in a manner of speaking, and has become one of the most, I think, authoritative opponents of the ideology he formerly espoused, and one of the most, I believe, impactful practitioners of that philosophy to come forward and warn the rest of us against it. He has done so, among other places, recently on the pages of a splendid publication by Hillsdale College called Imprimis, and also at a summit that we're going to be talking about a bit more with our next guest, Dean Michelle Bachmann, that took place recently at Regent University. We're delighted to have him with us. Dr. Rechtenwald, thank you for joining us as always, and also for your clarity on the challenges we're facing from the Marxists amongst us.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
Well, speaking of what I would regard as at least radical leftist, if not full-on Marxist, I wanted to get your thoughts about the nominee for the next Associate Justice in the Supreme Court, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. You've seen the type before, a distinguished academic turned attorney turned judge, who has, along the trail, I think, evinced a quality in her both public defending and legal work that has made her the darling of Black Lives Matter, among others. Should we be concerned about having such an individual on the Supreme Court of the United States in a lifetime appointment?
I think so, Frank. I mean, she's shown that she has no sense of equality before the law, that she prefers, you know, so-called beleaguered or subordinated identity types, and she rules in their favor even when they're child pornography consumers. So, I mean, and purveyors. So she's, I think, not going to rule in a way that that has, you know, that regards equality before the law as the main principle for adjudicating cases. I find it to be dreadful. Plus, I've tried to read some of the things she writes, and frankly, you know, having been a professor, I don't understand how she doesn't know how to write. She doesn't make a lot of sense. So I wonder how clear her thinking really is, because, you know, that's usually a symptom of unclear thinking, is the inability to express thoughts in a clear, coherent manner.
Well, another possible theory, and I think this would fit the profile, if you will, is that it's an effort to disguise some of her thinking. And it's not until you get to the place where nobody can remove you and you can have really limitless power in a way that you might sort of part the veil and be very clear about what your philosophy is. But just on this identity politics point for a moment, she says she can't define a woman. She seems to be, as you say, lenient in the extreme with respect to these consumers and purveyors of child rape and torture, even of babies. It's been unbelievable, I think, for all of us who've watched this play out. Also an admirer of critical race theory and the Black Lives Matter movement. So given all of that, what kind of role would you expect her to play on the Supreme Court, an institution that is rooted very much, it seems, in sort of the idea of collegiality and trying to find common ground among the justices?
Well, I think she's going to be an activist promoter of a particular agenda, and that is the critical race theory agenda, which is to replace the typical class underdog with racial and other identity groups, and to make their agenda trump all other considerations. In fact, that's what her very nomination represents, is the trumping of competence and credentials by identity. So we have identity promotions here, and she's going to be a promoter of identities, just as she has been the recipient of promotion on the basis of identity.
A radicalizing force, in short, and one that would be very worrying, I think, in terms of the position of the court. Let me turn to the issue that you addressed in your essay in Imprimis, and also at Michelle Bachmann's recent Regent University Summit, namely the Great Reset. This is a term that's bandied about a lot. Without getting into the history of it, what does it really represent, as you see it, with your insight into sort of the ambitions of not just, well, I guess, woke global capitalists these days, but their fellow travelers, if I can use that expression, among others in the Chinese Communist Party?
Yes, what it represents, you know, in the clearest, most simple terms, is the total politicization of the economy. And that is no longer allowing a free market to operate, and as such, instead dictating the terms of production and consumption on the basis of political considerations like climate change, like identity politics and social justice issues, and like what they call governance, which is basically how well does a corporation cooperate with the dictates of the state. So it's really a socialization process. It's a socialization of the economy. That's the economic part, at least.
Right. And I'm glad you had that caveat, because that's clearly only part of the overall purpose, is it not? And again, doesn't this really call to mind some of your past, you know, experiences with the political agenda of this, if I could use it, a left and globalist.
Yes, one of the things it does, it serves to basically cancel. It's cancel culture taken to the corporate level. It cancels out non-compliant, non-woke corporations and businesses and funnels capital differentially to the woke, agenda-driven capitalist producer. So it's a monopoly scheme, really. It helps these woke corporations to monopolize the economy and to starve off other producers of capital investments.
You wrote in the Imprimis piece, and I know I've spoken to this elsewhere as well, about the degree to which the World Economic Forum has been helping to engineer these exercises that seem to have been more or less designed to establish the playbook for the COVID pandemic and how it could be exploited by this axis, if you will. Just walk us through that quickly, because that's such an important insight.
Yeah, just briefly, two simulations were run prior to the onslaught of COVID-19, and that were called Clade X and Event 201. And these were simulations in which there was a national, in the case of Clade X, and an international response, in the case of 201, to a pandemic. In particular, Event 201 was a response to a global coronavirus pandemic. This was run 2 months before coronavirus hit. And they simulated the response to the pandemic, and every response that they took just so happened to have been echoed entirely by the responses of governments to the pandemic itself, the actual COVID-19 pandemic, including lockdowns, censorship, flooding the social media and media with authoritative sources, as they put it.
And canceling those that they regarded as inconvenient or unauthoritative, even if they had remarkable credentials in the field. And to your point, sir, this, you know, again, strikingly, the 201 event had the Chinese Communist Party represented at the table and participating in the exercise, as well as presumably garnering insights as to how to proceed. To the extent that what came out of all of this is kind of what's become called the China model that we've all been induced to follow, it really does seem strikingly, coincidental, to say the least, that this plan has been mapped out in this fashion. Do you think it's a coincidence?
Well, you know, that's an issue. That's a question I'm not going to adjudicate. I'd leave that to others. If I take that bait, I'll be deemed a conspiracy theorist. I'm just relating the historical facts. And I think that it's up to the listener to determine whether they think this was either so prescient and prophetic on the part of the World Economic Forum and their partners, or simply, you know, that there was some coordination. I'm not saying they coordinated the release of the virus. I'm saying they coordinated the governmental and policy responses to the pandemic. So that's the question, and I'll leave it to the listener to decide.
Well, I think you're right to be circumspect on that question, but let me just say, as somebody who's been accused of conspiracy theorizing wrongly, I believe it does seem to me that if it walks like the proverbial duck and quacks like it and so on, we're talking about a duck. Dr. Rechtenwald, thank you for what you're doing to help raise the awareness about the challenges that we're facing. I hope you'll come back to us with more very soon. Next up, we'll speak to the great Michelle Bachmann. This and more straight ahead.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last night, Tucker Carlson announced a death watch for the Biden presidency. In one of the most insightful and pathetic video clips in American political history, he showed the President of the United States being shunned by former President Barack Obama and, God help us, future President Kamala Harris and everybody else at a recent White House event. Think of it as dead man shuffling. Tucker not only confirmed what I said here 10 days ago, quote, Joe must go, unquote. He powerfully showed that to now be the consensus in partisan Democratic circles. The chilling prospect of Kamala ascending and or the curtain being pulled back on what is, effectively, Obama's third term demands an urgent effort to identify and recruit a nonpartisan vice president. Someone of real accomplishment, with a robust national security background, and who will promise not to run in 2024. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and it's a delight to say welcome to our next guest. We had earlier in the program one of the best serving members of Congress. We now have one of the best former members of Congress. Her name is Michelle Bachmann. She served for four terms representing people of Minnesota in the United States House of Representatives. She has gone on to a number of other very important activities. She is the co-chairman of the Jerusalem Prayer Breakfast, which I had the privilege to participate in Dallas last week. She is also, these days, the Dean of the Robertson School of Government at Regent University, and she's just done an extraordinarily important symposium, and we're going to talk about both what's going on with respect to Israel and the Middle East more generally, and about the Great Reset. Michelle Bachmann, it is wonderful to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks, Frank. It's always a thrill to be with you.
Asking you, today we learned that the chairwoman of the coalition government of Israel has withdrawn from the coalition. It has now lost its majority. As we speak, it's a little unclear what the next step is, but it seems very likely that Benjamin Netanyahu, the longtime prime minister of Israel, will come back to office in one way or another. I'm anxious to talk with you about both your deep passion about Israel and the importance of having strong, experienced, convicted leadership of the Jewish state at a moment like this when it's under arguably the greatest threat of its history, certainly its modern history, from Iran, and a lot of unhelpful things being done to it by the Biden administration here as well.
Frank, you've set the table very well. That's exactly what Israel has been experiencing. Tremendous turmoil. As many of your viewers know, there was something like four or five elections to even get to the point of relative instability that Israel has been dealing with. No one really knows what has been up and down. It's been a difficult alliance, to say the least, with the current governing coalition. So this is shocking news today, but yet not completely unexpected, because Naftali Bennett was in a shared government. He was expected to complete his term before too long, and then Lapid would come into place. And so now, if Benjamin Netanyahu comes in, he would be a known commodity. He was the longest serving, as you know, Frank, the longest serving prime minister that Israel had had in her history. And so I think in this world of great instability, especially during this time of war in Ukraine with Russia, and with the world standing by, wondering what's about to happen, with a very weak horse, the United States, I would have to say, on the world stage, we are not a strong horse today. We are the weak horse nation. That's also fired great instability in the region due to Iran. We'll talk more about that. But I think if Netanyahu would come back into the prime minister's seat, I hope a coalition will come around that. Then at least we will have one strong leader on the world stage. And we need a strong leader right now. So in some ways, this may end up being a great day.
It could be very providential indeed. We do want to talk about Iran, but maybe in the broader context of what the administration of Joe Biden has been doing to really undermine Israel, not only through its negotiations of the most hapless, pathetic sort with the mullahs of Iran, but also the damage it's done to allies of the United States, relative friends at the very least, in the Gulf states, and the Abraham Accords and emboldening the terrorists of Yemen and Hezbollah and elsewhere. To set the stage for us to how serious a time this is for, well, not just the Jewish state, but for our vital interests in that region as well.
Frank, it is a very difficult time now across the world because President Trump had brilliantly knitted together and fashioned a very different Middle East where the United States was extricating itself in a way, leaving peace in its wake. That's a highly unusual action if you look at the last 2 to 3 decades of the United States foreign policy history. And one thing I often say to audiences, Frank, is that a president can turn an economy around fairly quickly if we have a difficult economy. What's very hard to do is to undo foreign policy errors and mistakes. President Trump made some great moves on foreign policy, particularly with Israel and with the Gulf state region, as you had mentioned. But under Joe Biden, it's been a completely different story, a tragic story, if you will. First of all,
is what I call it.
Yeah. I think sometimes, as we all know, personnel is policy. And when Robert Malley is put in charge, not only of the Iranian agreement, but also put in charge of the entire Middle East region, that sends a signal. And so the Gulf states know whether they're in or out. They see right now they're out when it comes to the Biden administration. So what does that mean? That means that MBS doesn't pick up the phone when Joe Biden calls. And as your listeners know, he from Saudi Arabia or MBZ of the UAE. I've met with both of those men in their palaces, in their respective countries. They had a wonderful fondness for President Trump and a great working relationship, by the way. This is a complete about face. They know that the welcome mat has been pulled for them from the White House, and therefore they've looked elsewhere for friends.
In the face of attacks from the Houthis, the Iranian proxies in Yemen.
The last couple of weeks is the story that's emerged that now Saudi Arabia has turned to China, China that labels the United States their greatest enemy. Russia, who labels America its greatest enemy. North Korea, who labels America as its greatest enemy. Now we have the Gulf states turning to China. And so now we're hearing even more so that oil sales may be conducted in the Chinese currency. This undermines the United States in a way that is so devastating on the financial end, on our relationships.
Unfortunately. No. Michelle Bachmann, we have to take just a very quick break. We'll be right back with more about, another challenge for the United States, the Great Reset. What Michelle knows about it right after this. We're back, and we're joined I'm pleased to say, still by Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. She has become the dean of the government school in a terrific university, Regent University. And in that role, she's been doing some real serious educational work, not just of the students there, but also of larger audiences that have been able to take advantage of some wonderful symposia that she has held on, among other things, election integrity, and most recently, on the globalist agenda for the world, a reset of epic proportions is seemingly what they have in mind. Very distinguished group of people were pulled together to talk about it, and we wanted to visit with her about her principal takeaways from this. Michelle, tell us a little bit about not just the symposium, obviously, but also about the insights that it provided about what global capitalists, so-called, have in mind for this country and the rest of the world, for that matter.
The Great Reset, people have been hearing that term, globalism, the rise of authoritarianism, the Davos group that meets, the World Economic Forum that meets in Davos, Switzerland. They've been meeting twice a year for many, many years. And now recently, people not just in the United States, this isn't just Democrat, Republican, people all across the world, particularly in Western-oriented democracies, also are experiencing what we're experiencing in the United States. And so people are saying to me all over the world, I speak all over the world, and they say to me, Frank, what is happening in the world? Something is really strange. Are we ever going to go back to normalcy? And the answer is that organizations like the World Economic Forum, who just sponsored their own summit directly after our summit was held the next day, it was called World Government Summit. Now, before, if you talked about the idea of one world government, you would be considered a kook. But today, you've got CNN, you've got eminences from all over the world attending the World Government Summit. And why is that? It appears what we're looking at is a one world economy with a one world system of government led by a few oligarchs. In other words, if you think of what Russia is today, it's essentially an oligarchy. That's what these multi-billionaires are planning for the world, a world that's run by oligarchs. And that is, that strips us of our individual liberties and freedoms. It takes down the nation state of the United States, and we become weak, and then we become part of this global consortium. One very concerning aspect that came up is the fact that they're announcing very boldly that we're looking at the end of money systems as we have them, and we're looking at the rise of digital currency. And with the rise of digital currency, it also means the end of accounting. So imagine that, the end of accounting, because we're looking at a blockchain system where literally every time you have, every person would have their own ID number, their own social identification number in the world. And then based upon that number, we would use a digital form of currency, and every transaction would be recorded by a central bank. But also, the money is programmable, meaning the central bank decides how we can spend the money and where we can spend the money. That's just one example of where we're going. They're not looking at this. They're looking at doing this fairly soon. And one thing that's very odd, President Biden, also at this symposium, they talked about the fact that we're looking at a tremendous cyber attack. Well, how do they know? How do they know there's going to be a cyber attack? And if there is, China has been the one who's been behind most of the cyber attacks in the world. If that happens, if all, for instance, all financial banks and systems are knocked out in the United States, imagine you can't go to have a financial transaction this afternoon. You can't order anything online. That's how high stakes bingo this is. So that's what we addressed in our sims that are going on. We brought in world-renowned scholars to unpack the World Economic Forum and where the Great Reset is headed and how it'll impact America and the world.
Well, again, I commend you for your leadership on this score. And as it happens, just before you joined us, we had one of the speakers, Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, who, as you know, is very clear about what we're up against.
Indeed.
Well, and a former Marxist professor, which I think makes very much more valuable his insights, as a matter of fact. But let me just connect a couple of dots here, Michelle Bachmann. We have China, as you mentioned, in the mix. These global capitalists, you'd think, wouldn't want any part of China, and yet they seem to be very much disposed to make common cause. And I'm not so sure whether it'll be the oligarchs at the end of the day that will be running things or the Chinese Communist Party. But what does seem clear is they're both intent on taking down the United States of America as the impediment to the realization of their global designs. And what you just said is so vitally important, that to the extent that they're able to get their hands on our currency and manipulate it or control it or deny us the use of it, if you will, it's a huge problem, is it not?
Well, it changes our world forever. Our world would never be the same again. And that's what their goal is, that the world would never be the same again. I want everyone to know, Frank, that this conference that we held is available for all of your viewers to watch free. We made it free. We want this information to go widely spread. People can access this at my university, regent.edu/globalism. Again, it's regent, regent.edu/globalism. So you can watch all of the speakers, and you can forward the material to other people. You'll be very happy that you watched this forum. It was very well done with great information. It wasn't boring. So please tune in, because this is the main event that's happening in the world today.
It so desperately needs to be understood as such. We talked earlier in the program with one of your former colleagues, Congressman Chris Stewart, about how vital it is that there be a course correction in this country. And this webinar and your insights and those of your colleagues make that all the more imperative. Congressman Michelle Bachmann, thank you for your leadership and your continuing service to our country. It's really deeply appreciated, as is the courage and brilliance that you bring to the task. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to join us in doing just that. Check us out for more information at securingamerica.tv, and then go forth
and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.